quote start with, this is from a paper by David Bainbridge.
First founding member to leave out language. It's a recent paper given at the University of Bath to a symposium called Arcadia Revisited, where he's talking about galleries. Arcadia is a place created specifically by words. Do we need the words to reassure ourselves that our otherwise mute activity has a culturally significant form? Might a concern to revisit Arcadia represent a move from the idea of the museum as the place where experience is prior to knowledge, to the place where knowledge takes precedence? Judith, must I? Just some anecdotes to kind of get the feel of the thing. I was sitting on in leisurely Leamington Spa one Sunday in the mid-80s when one of my daughters came in and said, there's a phone call from Canada from a guy called Jeff Wall. So I thought I'd get the name dropping out of the way to start with. So I went to the phone. There's what seemed to me to be an incredibly laconic North American accent, inviting me to Vancouver in, I don't know, 10 days' time. So it was very quick anyway. So I went back into Sue and said, I must be the reserve. Somebody's let them down. It turned out I hadn't. Anyway, it was for a series of talks that they gave at the Vancouver Art Gallery of allegedly important artists casting pearls before near swine. She had in mind, I think, to curate a show of my work, except I stopped it several times. So I think one of the most interesting things to me about our exchange were the differences we had. The differences, or the differences I thought we had anyway. Something may have come of it, but of course it was cut off by a tragic death. The difference really turned on our view of curating. I thought she had a view of curating which celebrated the artist, the artistic subject, far too much. And I think she thought that my self-effacement was a coy cover for a megalomania. So, I always write as if I'm going to speak for 2 hours, which is what I often do in the circuit I'm most comfortable on, which is the British Art School circuit. Today I've been threatened with all sorts of punitive measures if I overstep the absolute limit of 20 minutes. So this is going to be really bullet points. I've got 8 bullet points here. Have I got 8 or have I got 7? Some of them are so long, I can't tell. I've got 7. And I'm going to rattle through them with keeping my eye on the watch, because 40 years of work, to kind of condense 40 years of work into a few meanders through slides is going to be a first in 20 minutes. Here's the points. Point one. Assuming my practice can be characterized as being driven, and this may sound very presumptuous, but I presume it singles me out from no other artist, since I take all artists to be driven in some way or another. Assuming my practice can be characterized by being driven, then I take it to be driven by a concern to prioritize critique and interrogation over celebration of critique and interrogation. Point two, the object of this concern has been a steady one, a concern to direct this critique and interrogation upon the avant-garde model of the artistic subject, and in so doing, seek to reconceptualize the criteria for identifying what constitutes a practice. Point three, the resources for charging this critique have frequently and increasingly been drawn from areas other than the area of art practice. These resources have come from such areas as philosophical logic, philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, cognitive science, artificial intelligence. That's roughly the 60s inheritance. That's the art and language exchange inheritance. Point four, staying with the metaphor of the practice being driven, to further try to sustain and elaborate the metaphor, I enlist the idea of the practice having a driving seat. In the very broadest terms, two main areas of concern have tended to occupy this seat, a concern with philosophical issues and a concern with political issues. I do not think that either concern has ever occupied the driving seat to the total exclusion of the other, not least because I find it hard to draw a well-defined boundary between the two. Since I do tend to characterize the conditions of my practice in this kind of way, I would say that in the 40 years of my practice, philosophical concerns have tended to be the dominant occupant of the driving seat for much longer periods. Point five, the concern to interrogate the avant-garde model of the artistic subject has a necessary correlate. If practice conventionally is identified as and through a given object production, then first, I have a relatively expanded or distended view of practice, or view of what may count as an object, and second, an adjunct to this is that, as a kind of Siamese twin, a relatively expanded and distended view of what may count as practice. This fact is worth noting here. Thus, perhaps it is worth noting here that a typical engagement of the practice has been an inquiry into what is to count as an object of production in the practice, and it follows from this that a central part of the practice is to inquire into what is the practice. My view of practice, for example, typically includes teaching exchange and conversational encounters such as this one here today. More specifically, in the context of today's encounter, the attempt I make here today to interpret my past practice, I may count as part of my present ongoing practice. In saying this much, I'm arguing that not only the relations of production of the practice are not confined to those relations of production which take place in what is familiarly termed some such as the physical space of the studio, but also that at least some important aspects of the relations of distribution are frequently seen as ongoing relations of production. For example, such a view necessarily, I think, may lead to a view of the museum as a site of ongoing direct production. Point six. Excuse me. Point six. With hindsight, I would characterize every period of my practice as being concerned in one way or another to interrogate the avant-garde model of the artistic subject, and in so doing, to be concerned with distending the notion of practice. The concern, for example, with interpersonal exchange and intersubjective production may have been exemplified in my role in helping to found the two groups I was associated with in the 60s, Fine Arts, which I helped found in 1964 whilst I was a student at the Slade School in London, and the Better Known Art and Language, which I helped found in 1969 with David Bainbridge, Michael Baldwin and Harold Hurrell. Whilst the inquiry into how people address and allegedly learn from each other may have been and still be an important concern in our practice, equally important has been a concern to inquire into the matter of how we address and identify ourselves. Last point, point seven. As a result of all these concerns, the practice has been saturated with an engagement with language, not least the relation between the visual, whatever that might be, and writing speaking. This has often taken the form of an attempt to explicitly represent and render within the practice a notion of voice. It is a concern with looking and reading, and to finish where I started, between what David Bainbridge contrasts in the quote I used to open these remarks, between experience and knowledge. First slide, please. All right. I can't see it. Okay. Thanks. This is kind of brief historical addenda, which I'm going to flash by as quickly as I can, because just to quote back to Vera's remark about quote from Judith about the 15-year war about the history of our language, to recount that war would take 15 years. This is an early David Bainbridge made when he was a student at St. Martin's School of Art in about 1965-66, what he called aphoristically his furniture sculptures. The concern with cybernetics is not obvious in there, but there was one. The concern with philosophy of mind, etc., is not obvious in there, but there was one. It's the problem with the visual, a lot of things are not obvious. There's not a language acid box, 1966, a box painted with acid and a mixture of, as I recall, lead paint. Sorry. If it was higher, you'd get a size as well. When I get on to the later stuff, I'll be dealing with the logistics. Now, from this point, this is just, as I said, an addenda to use art language as a reference on the kind of map of the practice. The next work was not how to get into art language, but how to get out of it. So this next body of work is a direct response to trying to overcome and develop, expand past habits of loyalty, which I got into with regard to the group over 8 years' practice. And this starts about 1974-75. I've got to be, as I said, I've got to be unnecessarily brief in terms of the material, but necessarily brief in terms of the symposium and your tolerance. So I'm being necessarily brief. And in being necessarily brief, I'm going to miss quite a lot. The World War One work came out of, is a long path to get to World War One. I haven't got time to go along that path, so we have to live with it. But the World War One work came out of a concern to figure out why I was so troubled by being avant-garde, say circa 1972, the 1972 documentary, where art and language had a huge index. There was certainly some problems within art and language. The relations of production in art and language had become, to my mind, hierarchical. They'd become bosses and workers. The group was, the index involved, I can't remember exactly how many, but probably a dozen people. So the group was expanding fast. Some of these were Americans. Joseph Kasuf was one of the people who was involved in the art and language index. You might find it hard to trace that now in the way the history's been written, but he was a key operator in it. And a lot of students at Coventry, where Art and Language had founded their art theory course in 1969, were involved. And they did a lot of the kind of donkey work on the project. That certainly was a source of my unease, my growing unease with the group. But I think it wasn't really an unease with the group. This is hindsight, it wasn't clear to me then, but maybe 5 or 6 years later I was beginning to get some take on it. I was more concerned with, I was more uneasy with the whole position of what might constitute the artistic subject, the one I keep calling avant-garde. So I think the work from now on is directed at trying to figure out what is the subject and what is the practice. I'm just going to read the titles of these because they use language a lot. They use two sorts of kind of museum, or two kinds of preoccupation with a museum. One was with the kind of presentation you get in the Imperial War Museum in London, which is a kind of, let's say, in dealing with the First World War, you'll get a piece of language underneath the image which says this is the Princess Patricia's Light Infantry, the Canadian Infantry, approaching Vimy Ridge on August 17, 1917, or whatever. That kind of operation. The other one was with how to somehow get hold of the fact that the resource of expression that I was choosing also had a history, not only the subject which I was depicting. This one's titled The Long-Winded, Hysterical and Pretentious Titles of Marxist Prejudice, Event, Tank Shit, Shrapnel Made by Krupp Essen, Bursting Upon Mark I Tank, Made by Metropolitan Wagon and Finance Company, Wensbury, Staffordshire, England, Black Watch Dundee and New Zealand Otago Infantrymen, Battle of Flesh, Cruselect, September 1916, Contain Gouache and Black Paper, 227.5 times 2707 centimetres, 1979. So to get that one straight up, the logistics may well be included in the title if the title's been presented by voice, which it is now. If it's presented by as text, then something else happens. But the two issues of voice, the voice recorded as text and the voice recorded as, so to speak, audio voice, are some of the things that, if we get to it, some of the later work tries to raise. Question, but answer, shut up and listen. And so it could go on. So if these are represented, the possibility these days would be to have a printer and have an endless text coming out of these things, printing all the time, or have an endless loop printing the voice. First,
this is a series called
Postcards from Trotsky. I can't remember how many exactly there are, about
7, 8. The big pictures,
they purposely stay with the very traditional notion of a tableau,
but they attempt to try and saturate them with an accompanying text, and in this case, a reproduction of what of the thing itself. This one's the starting.
I haven't got time to read it, and you probably haven't got the inclination to read it, even if I left it on long enough. I'll come to a few more details. I'll go on to the next one. Next one.
This is the postcard from Trotsky to Trotsky. I can use this to hook on to what I think were some of the interesting questions about how what the relations of distribution that works like these might amount to in terms of them leaving my relations of production. These were first shown at the Big Show at the Whitechapel Art Gallery in London in 1983. And I hadn't really thought out that what I'd done is I'd painted these big pictures. And I hadn't really figured out how I was going to present them. And I didn't know I hadn't figured out how I was going to present them until I had to present them. I contracted to show so many pictures of the Whitechapel Art Gallery, and having got this along the wall, I said, I'd like the picture. This is not the Whitechapel Art Gallery, this is the Kunstwerk in Berlin in 1995.
I'm speaking to the mic because we're recording it.
Be good.
Right.
This is at Kunstwerk in Berlin in 1995, and this was the first time this had been shown since the Whitechapel Art Gallery, which is whatever it was, 12 years, something like that. That's another long story as to why it took so long. But by the time they got to Berlin, I'd got that straight in my head that I needed to figure out how they're going to present it. So what we did, I wanted them presented as text, as painted text, the same size as the image. And I haven't got time to go into that one either. That's what I wanted. What we finished up with was the canvas is 13 feet by about 9 feet, I mean. And give you the exact size in centimetres. No, I can't. But anyway, it's about that size, and we finished up with another canvas in English, the text in English, 13 feet by whatever, another one in German, 13 feet, and we had one in Russian which we couldn't get on the wall. So this also is another way of expanding and reconceptualizing the notion of the presentation of the thing, and also maybe either building up the layers of productive meaning or cancelling established layers of productive meaning or maybe cancelling the thing out altogether. There's another presentation. This thing in the foreground is a big Greece Union Jack, about 30 feet long, which is about slippage of identity. Greece, you know. And it's directed at the border that runs between Northern Ireland and the Republic. Here's a set of pictures called the Happy Snap History Snap. These are a changing tack because, in terms of the metaphor of the driving seat, what had happened during the period of eruption of the Trotsky postcards and the World War I works is, firstly, Margaret Thatcher had been elected, and secondly, the time I was doing the Trotsky postcards, she'd won the Falklands War, which meant not only had she been elected, she was going to get elected again. And probably again, she did. So what I, for the first time probably ever, I think, in my practice, I put the finery of philosophical logic to one side and thought, this is, if I'm going to do some dissenting work, politically dissenting work, this is the time to do it. The black knight of Thatcherism was upon us. So the show I did, which was at a gallery in London, Gimbal Feast Gallery, was a show called Out for the Bunker. And it was divided into two halves. One was about family and about a concern with nuclear war. I take it that concern came from the fact that I was raised with that generation, born in 1939, so I was six when Enola Gay dropped Little Boy in Hiroshima. That generation that was, I think, particularly hung on the wire of the Cold War, on the kind of edge, not quite knowing how, what, which. By this time we'd got kids. So there was a direct projection into the future in relation to those sorts of ideological concerns. And Thatcher was a serious, as far as we could see, it was a serious threat to it. Not only in terms of the more direct warrior mentality she had in terms of confronting the Russians, etc., but in terms of confronting the enemy within, as she called it. Now, the enemy within, the primary object of that exercise was this massive miner strike in Britain between 1984 and 1985. But the more long-running hysterical agenda was the one directed against the Provisional IRA in Ireland. Okay, I've got 2 minutes. And the other serious confrontation which affected us directly was her education ministers were making serious inroads into the resources of the education which our kids were now moving into. These were about that, basically. This is Happy Snap 1, Amber on the beach waiting for cruise missiles to come and protect her future. Happy Snap 6, after having seen Manet's strong work, Ruby and Amber wonder which bunkers are earmarked for his pictures. They ponder as to whether in the cities where the Manets are, all of the neutron bomb will be used. So I'll do just the Irish works and then finish. Okay. We're way down there. There's 35 more years' work. This is a thing called the Stone Touchers, pretty much the same theme. This was, I think, was bought by Judith Mastai. But these, the ones I want to get onto are the Irish works, because the show was divided into a white half and a black half. The white half was to do with the family and the Thatcher Act propaganda about the return to Victorian values, etc., etc., all that stuff. And the other half was to do with Ireland, where we were active in CND politics on the one half, and we also had, I speak we in terms of Sue, my wife and I, we also have some sympathy with Republican aspirations in Ireland. And having sympathy with Republican aspirations in Ireland means you can't pussyfoot on violence, whether you like it or not. There's just a chance you might get it. So the black half was to do with what's called the Irish work now. I'll read two, and then I finish, I promise. This is in a black bunker in Armagh, with plath wall graffiti, two species of Goya creatures coexist for the moment with a small water tank. One species is a wall sucker, one characteristic of which is to press its head to the wall and refuse to look when under historical pressure. The other species, whilst it has beautiful wings, ideologically evanescent and luminous, since these wings have evolved upside down, it cannot fly and is therefore condemned to spend life on the bunker floor. Neither of these characteristics bodes well for the survival of the species. two Goya chickens parading on a bumper slip. Inside, four connected Tesco bags. And last one. No. Strange. Missing. So why not in there?